the sparking contacts on a fish tank heater, for instance, and maybe you can talk the person into improving that fish tank heater so it's not making all of that noise. In some cases, the guy, let me drop this. In some cases, a guy found out that there was a sparking contact on the bell transformer that operated the doorbell on their house. And that sparking transformer sitting in the basement with its wiring throughout the house to the back door bell and the front door bell button was acting as the antenna and radiating all kinds of arcing and sparking noises of an intermittent nature. Also, by keeping records of is the noise that you're hearing more prevalent during the 8-hour business day than it is at midnight, so to speak, and does it go away late at night, or does it get worse at night? Are you hearing it worse during the time that you're getting band openings? There's other clues that may help you pin down the source of noise that's giving you the grief, John. K2, Foxtrot, Quebec Uniform, mobile, K2RIW in the tech van.
K2RIW, K2SUU. Well, I noticed it in the past couple of days that I was getting RF when I was transmitting on the 6-meter on the repeater. And I noticed that whenever I enter into Brooklyn from the Bell Parkway off of Flatbush at King's Plaza, I make a left turn, and I'm surrounded by electric telephone poles, electric poles, and I know that that's generating a lot of noise. That's one thing, a positive that kind of evidence comes in. But I noticed the noise in a parking lot where I would never really notice this kind of noise on 6-meter or even 10-meter, and as you said, it could be just something within the vicinity. This parking lot was completely empty today. But as you said, try going around the area and what could be going on. If it's during the daylight, there are older fluorescent lamps on this private parking lot location, but they weren't on. I'm not sure if it's generating noise, and there is probably a good 1,000, 2,000 feet away.
And 1,000 or 2,000 feet away, if it's connected with Con Ed wiring, which can act as an antenna system for miles, you can be getting noise all over the place. The most sensitive antenna I ever had was that array of 16 Yagis on 432, which is pictured on that red QSL card, and also the picture itself is expanded on the mic number 2's website. You go to LimarkTechNet.com, and you will see a picture of me standing in the middle of an array of 16 Yagis that was mounted on a 100-foot tower. Because normal man-made noise falls off 60 beats per octave. Every time you double the frequency, normal man-made noise of a sparking nature goes down 60 beats weaker every time you double the frequency. Therefore, the average guy on 432 doesn't hear very much man-made noise. Well, that particular antenna, when I used to aim it toward the northeast, where there's a whole bunch of 130 or 230 kilovolt wiring, power distribution on Long Island, when I used to aim in that direction, my goodness, did I hear all kinds of noise. Lucky for me, that was a direction that didn't have many of the guys that I wanted to talk to on 432. The worst noise I ever saw with that antenna, of course, was the Montauk Point radar, which would sometimes give me spikes of noise 120 decibels stronger than the sensitivity of my receiver. So with that antenna, I could pick up some really strong noises in certain directions. So it's going to take some detective work to find out where the noise is coming from. Also, if anybody else has a 6-meter piece of equipment, let me drop a 6-meter piece of equipment that you can borrow, as long as you know it's got good sensitivity, and go from brand A receiver to brand B receiver and see if you get the same amount of noise. That would be a clue. And if you see no noise on the new receiver, be a little bit skeptical of that. You may find that the new receiver has got a 15 decibel noise figure, where your particular receiver with a good AR squared preamp on the front end has a 2 or a 1 dB noise figure. Therefore, as your receiver becomes more and more sensitive, as your noise figure becomes closer to the state of the art, you'll find out that more and more man-made objects make noise. And some of them might even be located in your own house. And sometimes guys have got to turn off various circuit breaker circuits in the house to find out which one is doing it, run everything on batteries and turn everything off in the house to find out is it your house or somebody else's house that's doing it. So pinning down noise, there's quite a learning curve to get good at that, but you'll eventually find out what it is as I see it, John. And when you do, please come back and tell us what you find. K2, Foxtrot, Quebec Uniform Mobile. K2 LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. I do have an AT that's able to receive on 6 meter, so I'll definitely try that out. I did get a signal report when I was speaking to somebody during the afternoon that I was coming in full quieting, but I was just I was receiving there with that static. That's just what the noise was there. Also, the area is out in Long Island, which I'm experiencing this over by a jet. But I understand exactly, as you said, to do a little bit more investigation. It could be just a temporary issue with either the power lines out in that area, which I do notice noise from 10 meters up to 40 meters when entering into that parking lot, passing by these older telephone poles. But I'll definitely investigate this and report back to you guys later on. This is K2FGU, K2RIW, back to TechNet. Thank you very much.
Good luck with that, John. Almost every situation of radio frequency interference, television interference, telephone interference, and whatever, computer interference, almost every one of those situations is solvable with the right kind of filtering and readjustment of the location of the antenna and the orientation of the antenna and the altitude of the antenna and putting filters on the equipment and so on. Almost every situation of undesired interference is usually correctable. If there happens to be a factory next door that is building a machine that does electronic shaping by way of arcing the material underwater and under an oil bath, I forget what they call that machine. There's a ham who lived in Deer Park, who is now a silent key, who had one of those factories next door to him. And in that case, without him moving to another location, there was no good solution. He could talk to that factory. They were making good money doing their work. And because of the method of operation of that equipment to properly shield it and properly bypass it so that the interference it was generating kilowatts of sparks in oil in order to do electronic shaping of metallic three-dimensional objects. Let me drop a call. So their procedure would allow them to do precision manufacture of three-dimensional metallic objects. But it ran at such high voltage, high current, sparking levels under this oil bath that to stop that noise that was on the same block with him, to stop the interference he was getting on his favorite HF bands, was essentially out of the question. He tried very hard. And the net result was, thank goodness the factory only worked during the 8 hour during the day. At nighttime they weren't there, and so he could do his DXing at nighttime. Because he was a serious DXer, he wanted to, and he was a retired person, he wanted to be able to operate his equipment during the 8 hour day. He almost could not do that. There are kinds of very high quality noise blankers, particularly the noise blanker that was in the Drake R4C receiver. Could tolerate some of that noise. I remember a loaning, that was W2DX, by the way, was his call letters, good ham radio operator. I loaned him my Drake R4 receiver, which has an extremely good noise blanker. Let me drop it. And with that receiver, 95% of all of those undesired spikes of noise from that factory essentially went away. I know that when I use that receiver, the particular kinds of spiking of noise I was getting from the Montauk Point radar, which was a many high megawatt radar. As I said, the radar could be giving me spikes that are 120 dB above my noise. I turned on that noise blanker of the Drake R4 receiver, and all of that noise disappeared. I could aim my antenna directly at the Montauk Point radar. I could listen to a weak guy on 432 off the back lobes of that antenna, and I had no trouble hearing him when I turned that blanker on. correspondingly, if I aim my antenna directly at the guy in New Jersey that I'm listening to on 432, and the back lobes of the antenna are aimed toward the Montauk Point radar, and if I turned off the noise blanker, I never even knew that that ham radio operator was on the air. Even though with the noise blanker turned on, his signal was 25 dB above my noise. That gives you some idea of what a really good noise blanker can do for certain kinds of noise, like radar noise. And when it comes to those high voltage sparking noise I was getting from the 130 volt kilovolt wiring of Long Island Lighting Company, a good 98% of that noise was eliminated by that particular noise blanker of that receiver. When I use that receiver as my tunable IF on the back end of a 432 converter. I was converting from 432 down to 7 megacycles, and that receiver tuned across 7 megacycles. With its blanker running, boy, the band turned, when it comes to spiking types of noise, the band turned quiet. So there are better and better noise blankers for certain situations. That's also something worth seeking, John. And so if you could borrow somebody's Drake R4C receiver that has the auxiliary noise blanker, unfortunately that's it didn't come native to the receiver. You had to buy it as an option. My goodness, was that a noise blanker. And so that used on 6 meters, I guarantee you would love the performance. So at least there is a solution out there. I didn't say it's easy. Good luck with that project. I think it's time for the mailbag, John. KC2WGB. Did we get any mail this week on the subject of interferometry? And the fact that for those who want to know about interferometry, because they may not have heard that one-hour lecture last week, let me drop that. It turns out that Mike, number one, did a very good job of recording that section. I played it back and listened to it, and my usual spoonerism errors, there weren't too many of them in there, so that one-hour or so lecture on the subject of interferometry, which is not only an extremely high application technique for high-quality radio astronomy, but it turns out that every single antenna you have ever used that has an antenna pattern, where the antenna pattern has a 3 dB beamwidth of the main lobe and locations of the first null and the first side lobe, that whole antenna pattern really is coming from interferometry taking place within the antenna itself, even though it doesn't look like an interferometer. Every antenna that has an antenna pattern, where is the pattern coming from? It is internal interferometry. All of the articles I've ever read on antenna patterns, all the courses I've studied, all the books that I own, do not do a good job of explaining that. They give you a formula, you say you plug in all the numbers to this formula, you know what the beamwidth of the antenna is, and you know what the side lobe level is. But you don't know where it's coming from. It's coming from interferometry. So in case you've missed that lecture, by going to last week's playback on QRZ, here we go, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website and you listen to last week's lecture of the Technical Net. You'll know quite a bit more about interferometry and why it's so valuable. So I wonder if we got any feedback on that subject this week, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment on the previous subject whenever I'm on the KC2.
Want to pick that up first, Dick?
Yes, I do. John, your audio is quite low, so shout into that mic a little bit more so that other people can hear you. I'm hearing you pretty well because I'm wearing a good set of earphones. K2 Sierra Hotel Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
It's probably better if I just switch radios here. Do you hear me better now?
Your audio is now a little bit louder, but it's still lower than I wish it was. But go right ahead. We're hearing you very well, John. Go ahead.
Okay, going back to the fan dipole, I have an Alpha Delta DXEE. It was my first introduction to the fan dipole. Now I'm getting lots of ideas about building them myself. But anyway, the question is, how does an antenna like that, and maybe this is all dipoles, how does being too close to the ground, or say too does the bathtub move around in frequency or only lose the dip, the level of the negative dB reading on the return loss? As a DXE is a fan dipole with a top element that has traps, what order would you tune that top element in? If the top element is 40 and 20. That's all. KC2, SHO.
One of the things that's kind of hard for us to believe, John, is that in every situation, there is always a tremendous amount of multipath. You set up your antenna on the top of your tower in Huntington, in my case, and you want to talk to a guy in Manhattan, and he's on the top of a high building. And so, if you had a powerful enough telescope from the top of my tower, I may be able to see his building in Manhattan, which, by the way, I can do from the top of my tower. I can count, I used to be able to count 51, now I can only count 50 of the buildings in New York City. Two of them fell down and one of them was replaced. Anyhow, so with line of sight, with my telescope, I can see the building. Therefore, I would easily assume that the signal from me goes straight over to that guy in that building in Manhattan. Yeah, that's one of a million paths. But there's a zillion ways that that signal can be bouncing off of the ground, the water towers, the buildings, the houses, the factories, and everything else. And all of those individual bounces are always taking place. And so all those signals get to that receiving site in Manhattan, and all those individual voltages of each one of those paths, with all of those individual delays of those extra paths, which are usually longer, they all get summed in a voltage manner at the receiving antenna. Let me drop. And so, depending on the weather conditions, where the if there's a lot of dew on the ground and the extra high moisture in the air gives a little bit more bending of the air, and therefore some of those individual bounced signals go in phase and out of phase with each other, and therefore you can get fading at midnight on a signal that's gangbusters at high noon, if you know what I mean. So it's the fancy way that all those multipaths are reflecting. In the case of an antenna that's mounted above the ground, that ground to you and I looks like it's got grass and dirt and flowers on it. To most of the radio waves that you and I talk about, 80 meters, which is a 240-foot wavelength, that ground looks like a nearly perfect mirror to that radio wave. It doesn't look like grass. It doesn't look like dirt. It looks like a mirror that's a little bit dirty in its reflectivity. The signal reflecting off the ground is not 100% as strong as it could be. It's 90% as strong, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So that signal that's transmitted by your antenna that was intended to go out in free space, the portion of it that went straight down to the ground, reflected off that ground, and came back to your antenna. As such, depending on the number of wavelengths down to the ground and back, and because a horizontally polarized signal, when it reflects off something that is conductive, like ground, experiences nearly 180 degrees of phase shift because of the reflection. A horizontally polarized signal bouncing off the ground usually experiences 180 degrees of phase reversal. A vertically polarized wave at a grazing angle off the ground does not. So as you can see, you got funny things going on here. That signal coming back off the ground is delayed in time by the distance down to the ground and back. It gets sucked back into your antenna as a receiving signal, even though you're transmitting, and it definitely affects your standing wave ratio. You could say that a good portion of the signal reflecting off the ground, hitting your antenna, becomes the reversed signal that your standing wave ratio meter measures. Your standing wave ratio measures how much signal goes forward on your transmission line and how much is coming back toward the transmitter. A good percentage of that ground reflection signal comes back as a signal flowing in the wrong direction on your transmission line. Let me drop. So your very logical question, as I see it, John, was, does it...
I have a question about the interferometry.
So your question is really, is it affecting the standing wave ratio? Is it affecting the center frequency? The answer is yes and yes. It's affecting all of the above. because depending on what phase angle it comes back, it can move the frequency higher or lower. There's even a slim possibility that your native antenna had a certain amount of reflected signal of its own. Your antenna may have had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That means 10% approximately of the power your transmitter puts out going toward the antenna. 10% of it is reflected back to the transmitter. That's what a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is. As such, the ground reflection, if you just happen to have just the right distance above the ground, the signal coming off the ground reflected could also be approximately 10% of your signal strength. There's a slim chance, if you're really lucky, those two signals end up 180 degrees out of phase. The signal natively reflected by your antenna and the signal reflecting off the ground could be nearly equal in magnitude, 180 difference in phase. Therefore, there's a slim possibility that the reflection off the ground would take your 2-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, and on your favorite frequency, it becomes a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna. No reflected signal at all, because those two signals are equal in magnitude and cancel. Don't hold your breath. That lucky situation doesn't happen very often, but I have seen it happen. It can happen. Let me drop. So ground reflection can give you all kinds of effects. As you raise the antenna higher and higher off the ground, the magnitude of the ground reflection goes down by the inverse square law. Let me think about that. Inverse fourth law. The signal has to go a certain distance down to the ground, reflect a certain distance coming back. It's inverse fourth law. Every time you double the distance off the ground, the amount of signal you get back, I think, is getting either 6 or 12 dB weaker. So altitude helps for two or three reasons. One, the guy you want to talk to over the horizon is going to get a stronger signal as your antenna gets higher. And second of all, the amount of ground reflection is going to go down. Now, ground reflection isn't always bad. Let me drop. If you're building an antenna range and you're doing it at HF frequencies, with rare exceptions, nobody has a good anechoic antenna testing chamber that is useful at HF frequencies. The wavelength is too big, the chamber is too small. Therefore, almost all antenna testing at HF frequencies takes place on an outdoor antenna range. You have no choice. And on almost every outdoor antenna range, you have a significant amount of ground reflection between the antenna under test and the antenna that's picking up the signal in order for you to measure the performance of that antenna under test. And maybe it's 100 feet downrange, so to speak, but there's a lot of ground reflection going on. Under normal circumstances, that ground reflection in that antenna range outdoors is a killer. Okay? You read the article by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, which is in the, let me think which book it's in, the antenna manual, the Aerial Antenna Manual, and it's on the paragraph entitled Transmission Lines and Antenna Testing. At the back end of that chapter, near the back end of the book, has the so-called reflective ground plane antenna range testing procedure, which was really made famous by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories. Let me drop. And you would think, common sense, that the best way to live with ground reflection is to make sure the antenna on the test is very high off the ground and make sure your sensing antenna is very high off the ground, very far away. Therefore, you're operating from the top of two mountains or the top of two buildings. Good common sense. Absolutely not. If you follow his procedure, you'll realize that the ground reflection, which is always going to be there, does not have to be a detriment. You can use it in your favor if you know what you're doing. And in many cases, the antenna doing the transmitting on your antenna range, and usually the antenna being tested is used in the receiving mode, if the antenna under test is almost flat against the ground, as low as you can get, and if you do it correctly, the right number of wavelengths of distance of antenna range and height of transmitting antenna and height of receiving antenna, you can use ground reflection in your favor. It can become a complement instead of a detriment if you know what you're doing. And obviously, arguably one of the world's best antenna ranges is the one at the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York. Let me drop. And whenever they do testing below something like 2,000 megahertz, all of it's done on an outdoor antenna range, a reflective ground plane antenna range, following the Dick Turin technique. So ground reflection is always there. What it does is reasonably predictable. It isn't always a huge disadvantage, except for some of our modern no-tune transmitters, which can't tolerate a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio without going into a low-power protection mode. But with a good antenna tuner, a 4-to-1 or a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio is easy to handle. The standing wave ratio of 5-to-1, you would think you're wasting half of your power, because that's exactly what happens at a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Half of all the power is reflected from the antenna structure and its environment. If you've got a wide enough tuning range of your antenna tuner, a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio is very easy to handle. And once you've got that antenna tuner set up correctly, your antenna can be giving you 95% efficiency, even in the presence of a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio. So there are ways of living with this, even though you think it's bad at first. One of them makes some sense, John. K2 Sierra Hotel Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And to extend for interferometry.
John first. Go ahead, John.
Yes, that makes very good sense, and I really appreciate you taking the time to explain that. You've already got the gears turning, and I do have the ARRL antenna book. I'm going to dig into that deeper. Thank you very much for that. I'll let you get back on subject here, and I think that's going to put me in the right direction.
As you're about to find out, John, an awful lot of these things with antennas that sounds at first like they are a showstopper. Once you figure out what's really going on, once you apply the right kind of hardware to accommodate the situation, almost all of these things that you think are a showstopper are not. There's usually a workaround. Go ahead with your interferometry question, Wes. W2XJN. Here we go. N2XJN. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, so again, actually, it's not a question, it's the comment. The number of emails that I have sent you, which you do not have an access to them today, was specially for the purpose of interferometry, which means that it has a close relationship with it. It is kind of very much interesting. We take electromagnetic communication and the phenomena where interferometry is being used. So what I was trying to do is, since the world didn't protest talk about it, give the floor to Roy in this area, because there are three emails and a number of interesting videos. Indeed, especially because you have made that subject available. Let me drop. And of course, the interferometric modeling of wave propagation is one of the tools that is being used in this area. I don't mean going back in time when I'm talking about time reversal. But my question is, are we going to ask today Roy to eventually talk about it, or are we leave it for the next week where your computer is going to be working and you would have at least ability to go to some materials? I promise you, you're going to be interested with it. And to actually,
I was doing some receiving over the last couple of days when you, Roy, John, the man in Manhattan, I can't think of his name right now, is Todd, we're discussing similar subjects. And as I heard that material, it is my belief that the majority of people on the TechNet will not be interested in that material. I could be wrong, but the method by which you guys were discussing it, I think, is going to put a fair percentage of our listening audience to sleep. That's just an opinion. But when I see your emails on that, when I get my machine working again, the computer maven in my house is my son Christopher, KB2IQN. I'm going to have him fix my computer, which is going into some kind of a massive failure today. And so I'll see those emails, and maybe I'll make a different judgment. But what I've been hearing in the last couple of days is a depth of theory. Let me drop. It's a depth of theoretical material and speculations and differing opinions among you guys as to what it is, how to explain it, and how to use it. And I think it's a little bit too blue sky and a little bit too off the beaten path of the interest area of action of the average ham radio operator. A guy could be interested in optical astronomy. He could be interested in radio astronomy. And those two items definitely reflect into ham radio. Some of the world's best radio astronomers, some of the world's best optical astronomers were ham radio operators. But the branch of theoretical material that you guys were discussing is beyond the interest of an optical astronomer or a radio astronomer in general. Therefore, I'm afraid that an awful lot of our hams will be put to sleep by it. As I said, I'm reserving judgment until I see those emails. But that's my first impression on what you guys have been discussing over the last couple of days, to the wee hours of the morning. You guys went on until like 4 a.m. on a couple of those days. In 2XJN, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, the discussion was actually covering a wide area of subjects, not necessarily related to the subject that I want to discuss. It was Todd who was rather interested with more casual conversation. I was interested with more scientific approach to the Atlantic job. But since we're talking about the optical optics, and then reverse asymmetry breaking in optical rotation when we use the interferometry, or say SAC interferometry in solids, whatever. I'm not going to talk about it because that would is going to be too far. Let me know. I would like you to judge for yourself. Don't take that subject today. Go to the email number 3, electromagnetic communication test bed, and judge by yourself. It was you who opened up the worm Pandora box. And then it is you who actually say, hey, anybody has a question or a feedback about interferometry? We want you to know that we listen to you and we value everything what you're giving to us. Now, instead, just use your judgment. Instead of saying, no, guys, you are too far away. You know, it's not something what we want to hear. And then let us know. And I believe the input that is being provided by Raw is a high top I would ever expect. Comparing to the information that we can get is on the level of Dick. So that would be interesting for me to just listen to it. But that's my opinion. What do you think about it? And to assure you.
At first, it's going to sound like I've got prejudice, John, against certain kinds of subjects that I think will or will not be of interest to our listening audience on the TechNet. John and I also get emails where people are expressing opinions, and they tell us specifically what they do not like. You're getting very close to those areas. So it's not just my opinion. I'm also going by some of the emails I get. Maybe John can discuss some of the emails he also gets. John, I'm going to pass it over to you for the mailbag section. And if you want to give us a couple of hints on what emails you get, on what people say they like and what they don't like, if you want to add to that, please do. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Thank you, Dick. Yes, definitely. Here's the issue. A question was posed 3 weeks ago about interferometry. There was no basic knowledge understood by a few people, one in particular. Okay, that was handled by you very well. Yes, we got a lot of questions this week in the email bag about it, and they're basically asking the same question. But its basic understanding of what it is, the concept. Forget all that esoteric crap. We don't have to get into that. Now, if the five of us want to go off frequency and talk about it because we're interested, that's great. But I don't think it's related to what the average interest of the basic concept of interferometry, I don't think it's going to help. Now, I believe you agree with that, Dick. Back to you.
I think we're on the same wavelength here, John. We start off as ham radio operators. I know of one of the prominent people signing into the TechNet 5 or so years ago. Heard us occasionally talking about radio astronomy and occasionally talking about optical astronomy. And this person who frequently signed in would say, you guys are getting too far off ham radio. I'm not going to listen to the TechNet anymore. Well, turns out that the kind of free thinking that goes into optical astronomy and radio astronomy, the scientific interest, and the scientific interest that a true ham radio operator has, really are kind of related. That exact same individual who told us, I don't want you discussing non-ham radio subjects on the technical net, I don't want you discussing radio astronomy and optical astronomy, that same person a couple of years later came onto the TechNet and asked us for giving him suggestions as to which telescope he should buy, because he's now going to take up astronomy as well as radio, ham radio. He's going to combine the two hobbies from his backyard, so to speak. So we do go fairly far afield in the fields of applied science when it comes to the TechNet. We apply science toward radio. We apply science toward optical astronomy and radio astronomy. And a couple of times we get into appliances, your microwave oven and whatever. They're all somewhat related, but it's applied. When we start getting highly theoretical about whether or not there is wormholes and a time reversal and whatever, 90-some-odd% of our audience will turn the receiver off and go away. So we got to be careful. We don't want to lose those people. We've got a certain let me drop.
Can you just tell me they on the meteor shower?
Okay, a very broken up signal told me that the word meteor shower. And I know there are meteor showers, and ham radio operators have basically discovered that meteor scatter propagation is something that's very useful under certain conditions. So that's very ham radio related. So applied science is what we talk about most of the time. When it comes to the highly theoretical, highly specular areas, we got to go light on that because a high percentage of our particular audience will not tolerate it. We've tried to not offend that audience. That's the reason why you're listening to TechNet number 1533. After 32 years, we're still here. We've angered some people. You can never please everybody. That's a given. But the majority of people, some significant number of people, apparently are pleased. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep coming back. That's a bunch of opinions. So we're in the mailbag section right now, so I'm going to go over to the mailbag, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW, go ahead.
I just want to know the thing on that meteor shower that's coming up.
KC2WGV, just let me finish my comment, Dick. Look, the TechNet went through that little evolution that we talked about. It changed a little bit, and we do have a science time where we're talking about deeper subjects, as you always suggest. But this is going too deep. We have to keep the basics. What Wesley is talking about is very interesting, extremely interesting. There's a lot of stuff there that's really nice, but it's not for everybody, just like you're saying. So we do have to adjust for the audience we have, and we can't please everybody that's listening, and we can't please everybody that wants to bring up topics. So maybe you want to pick up that other station, and I'll go on with the mailbag. Dick, back to you, KC2WGB.
Let me have a short comment.
Yeah, the Geminid meteor shower is in December, and now it's one of the major meteor showers of December, is my recollection. If you Google the word Geminid, in other words, the radiant of that meteor shower looks like it's coming from the constellation of Gemini, I guess it is, and December 8th is my recollection on that one, is when I think that one peaks. Do we have have a meteor shower person around that can tell us the name of the major meteor shower that happens in early December. Is it the Gemini meteor shower? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the tech net.
K2LR.
Go right ahead, Kay. Tell us about meteor showers.
Geminids are indeed the meteor shower in December. They're peaking this year December 13th, the evening of December 13th. And they're supposed to be a really good show this year. State parks are opening up Heckscher State Park in East Islip at like 9 p.m. And people can come down and observe. My astronomy club is going to be there, so we'll have telescopes out. Just dress really warm and bring lots of layers. Back to the net. This is AC2LR.
Signal tonight, Kate.
And if you haven't heard it up till now, or Kay, when you asked that question about interferometry, you got us on a... It was a very innocent-sounding question, but boy, did you get us into a very good subject that's got to be covered. As you probably heard that over the last couple of weeks, we tried covering it last week. We really did. Okay, December 13th looks like it's being recognized as a major meteor shower, and the majority of people who watch meteors do it with a naked eye, because the meteors can happen anywhere in that whole darn hemisphere of sky that you can see if you're in a good, dark location. And whereas, although if your telescope was exactly aimed in the right direction at the right instant, you would see that meteor a hell of a lot louder, brighter, and more fun to look at. That's the good news. The chances of you being able to... Let me drop. The chances of you being able to aim your telescope in just the right little section of sky during that exact instant of time when that meteor is coming through, the chances of you catching that meteor in your telescope is very, very small. The good news is your telescope gives you great light gathering and amplification. The bad news is that to a certain degree, using a telescope is like looking through a straw. You get a real bright, high-gain picture through that straw, but you're only looking at an extremely small section of the sky. The good news about good human vision is that the peripheral vision, in other words, a bright object can happen 50 degrees off to one side of the bore side of your eye, so to speak, and the cones off to one side of your eye will say, hey, something is happening over there. You'll sweep your eye over in a fraction of a second, and you'll watch that meteor. You cannot slew a telescope that fast, that accurately, in azimuth and elevation to catch that meteor during the few seconds it's there. So although people will do telescope observation during a meteor shower, because hopefully it's a nice dark night and there are other things to look at, but I think they tend not to use the telescope itself to catch those meteors. That's my belief, and Kay, correct me on that. AC2LR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's exactly right, what you just said. We're going to be watching the meteors, but we'll have other interesting things like galaxies and nebula to show if people, you know, want to, in between the meteors peak. Parking lot is parking lot 6. It's a pretty big park, so it's parking lot 6 at Heckscher State Park in East Islip. And the closer to midnight you can stay up, the more meteors you're going to see. That's what they're predicting. And the best way to watch them is to bring a lounge chair and just lay on the lounge chair and sleeping bags so you can stay warm. Back to the net. This is AC2LR.
And one other subject with reference to meteor watching, Kay. And some of the meteor observation sites that were chosen by the Astronomical Society of Long Island, ASLI, they went up north to, I can't think of the name of the place right now, but on the North Shore of Long Island. And the parking lot where you parked your car and the place where you did the observation were very closely related to each other. And people really doing a good job of watching meteors want to make sure their eyes are fully dark adapted. And so they don't want to look at bright objects during the whole a few hours that they're there. As such, you're supposed to drive into the parking lot with only the dim lights turned on, and turn them on only as little time as you can, so you're not you're blinding people, if you know what I mean. And yeah, there's a conflict of interest of having enough light in your automobile that you're not running into things. So try not to use your bright lights for a long period of time while parking is the recommendation by the ASLI group. I wonder if the group meeting at parking lot 6 of Hampshire State Park. I wonder if there was a similar request along those lines, Kate. And sounds like you're a member of that group. AC2LR, K2RIW.
Same etiquette, and the name of that group is Amateur Observers Society of New York, AOS, the Feather Astronomy Group on Long Island. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, but my question is, Kay, if people who are not yet AOS members go to parking lot 6 of Hexer State Park, is there a recommendation as to how they use the headlights on their automobile when they're pulling into that parking lot? Or is the place of observation so far away that that's not a problem? AC2LR, K2RIW.
Actually, no one discussed it because it's a public, I think it's going to be a news day or something, so they just don't know how to warn everybody. So I think we're just expecting that headlights are going to be blinding us. When it comes to meteor showers, it's not the same as having to look at really dark nebula, so like, you know, very faint objects. So I think if you can, keep the headlights away. It's like, you know, if you see somebody with a telescope, don't shine headlights on them. But, you know, it's going to happen. So when there's a public event, just kind of know that that's going to happen, I guess. AC2LR, back to you, Dick.
Thanks an awful lot for that information, Kay. Okay, the person who asked about the meteor shower, do they have any further questions? The meteor shower person, K2RIW. Okay, I think it's time to go on with the mailbag. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, I figured I'd just let it drop. Okay, Dick, before you ask me a question about the response to that little hour lecture you made, yes. And the questions are, they need to understand in a better way, maybe drawing a mathematical, maybe by drawing a mental picture of two telescopes, radio telescopes they were talking about, separated by a continent. Okay, and drawing or describing the lines that would depict one beam and make it a little easier, because they don't know how that is creating the interferometry. That seems to be the major problem with it. Of course, we can't cover that tonight because Paul's going to have a lengthy report, I guess, on Orion, which would be nice to hear. But maybe next week we could just touch on that to sort of clear up that end. Let me let it drop. Okay, so you can consider that whichever way you want to handle that. Now, I have one question in the mailbag that I would like to get in tonight before Paul. It's fairly easy, and I think you could do a good job on that. So, you're all right with that?
Go for it, John.
Okay, I would like you to describe, the person is questioning the transmission of information, whether it be video, audio, data, from the original point of generation to its receiving point, the electromagnetic spectrum, how it works in that fashion. And this is what they're questioning. We are going to take simple video analog signal, the basic camera set up on a stage, how it scans, how it sends that signal out as an RF wave, with synchronous lock, so that the, let's use a 3-scale, grayscale, and we can imagine little dots being drawn, and we will, I'm sure that they can understand how dots can represent a picture. That seems to be the easiest way to go. So we'll say we have 3 levels of grayscale on dots, and we draw a picture. How is that done? And they also need to know how that's synchronized. In a very basic way, that's what they're asking. And this is coming from a couple of people that are interested in transmissions. Different technologies, but video will explain exactly what most of them want to know, if you think you could put that together. Back to you, to KC2WGB.
Okay, there's really two portions to that question, John. Question number one is, how does a radio signal go from point A with a transmitting antenna to point B with a receiving antenna? And how does any kind of information get superimposed on that radio signal? That's the first portion of that question. The second portion of the question seems to be, how does a television analog camera work? How does it manage to take that picture of the celebrity standing in front of the camera playing his guitar? How is that picture broken down and made into an electrical signal, very similar to how is his voice broken down by way of that microphone? His acoustic mechanical sound in air created by his voice and his guitar gets picked up by that microphone. It moves the diaphragm. That becomes an electrical signal, and the electrical signal eventually gets sent out as a so-called sound wave from the transmitter, and the receiver reconverts it. So do you think the person is requesting more information on the first, how information is superimposed on a radio signal, or is the person more interested on how the picture in front of a television camera is broken down and made into an electrical signal with synchronization? Or is it the combination of the two? What do you believe is the nature of the question, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Good question, Dick. They basically understand the radio wave and the function, but if we could describe the amplitude modulation and the dot structure, let's take a simple image like a cross or an X. The camera, basically how it scans and reads it, we know it converts it into electrical signals, just like the microphone. You know, we get electromagnetic signals, which no matter if it's audio, video, or digital data. It's you, Dick.
Okay. I have a way of explaining it to my friends, which has worked pretty well. I'll try it on this particular group. Milo T. Farnsworth. He's a high school student in Utah. The year is roughly 1915. He knew that various people had come up with radio transmitters, and voice was able to be transmitted by what became broadcast radio stations. He knew that that was possible. He knew that people were dreaming about sending pictures instead of voice, or sending pictures and voice simultaneously. He knew that that was a future dream, very similar to a man in 1850 watching a bird saying, gee, I wish I could build something which would allow human beings to fly like that bird. So people in the late 1800s were dreaming about flying. And as radio was becoming beyond its early infancy, and it was eventually sending not only Morse code, but voice signals, people were dreaming about being able to transmit pictures with radio systems. Let me drop. And Mr. Philo T. Farnsworth watched a man plowing his field of his farm. And he said, wow, that's it. He watched the guy plowing the field. The first row, he went from east to west. And the next row, he went from west to east. And the next row, he went from east to west with his tractor as he's plowing the field. And line by line, he eventually covered the whole field. That was the beginning of the idea. He started explaining it to his chemistry teacher in high school, who partially understood it. And that became part of the confirmation of his patent application. Then he knew that once you have established these scan lines, by which you take this flat image that's projected by the lens onto your film, so to speak, if it's an ordinary camera, and as long as he can horizontally, in cyclic scan lines, in repetitive scan lines, go through the picture one line at a time. And as he sweeps across that line, if he hits a bright spot, the camera puts out a strong signal voltage. And if he hits a dark spot, the camera puts out a low voltage. And so by modulating the voltage coming out of the camera, as the dot of scanning takes place on each horizontal scan line, and let me drop. I think the very early television cameras had numbers like 300 or 400 horizontal lines. I think the early United Kingdom television had something like 405 and then 425 lines. And eventually United States settled on 525 lines, and eventually Europe settled on 625 scan lines. So the number of scan lines represents a compromise. More and more scan lines gives you a higher and higher resolution picture, but you now take more and more time to transmit it, or it takes more and more bandwidth to transmit it in a given amount of time. So there's a compromise. Nowadays, by fancy digital techniques, we're transmitting high-definition television, the equivalent of 1,000 or 2,000 or 4,000 lines. And now the picture displayed on your television screen is starting to get equivalent to what used to happen with a high-quality 35-millimeter Kodachrome slide, if you know what I mean. We're getting to the point where you don't know if it's live or Memorex.
Wait, why would a question on this subject?
So what Farnsworth did, Philo T. Farnsworth, the man who is accredited with inventing the television technique in the United States, Mr. Armstrong of RCA really took off with it, and by then the patent had expired. He didn't have to pay any royalties, and it eventually became a commercial product. But was it Armstrong or can't think of the guy's name right now from the RCA Corporation who really took over and didn't give Farnsworth very much credit or very much financial remuneration. So the concept of bringing it down into scan lines, where as the dot of observation in the camera sweeps across the photovoltaic surface, in theory you could put a zillion photo detectors, if they're small enough, side by side, and then use a switching network. Let me drop.
That was Sonor 6, WSLM.
That's the name I'm looking for, Sonor. So Sonor really took off with it after World War II, and Farnsworth worked so hard on the project but didn't get very much credit. He was doing the early work, and Farnsworth turned it into a commercial product, which became the RCA 630 television set. And in 1947, that was the be-all, end-all thing to own. And my grandfather and grandmother bought one for their farm in Kings Park, and they were one of the first people in the town of Kings Park that had a television aerial on top of their farmhouse. And I would frequently visit them and watch Howdy Doody and trying to think of some of the other things. I can't think of the great comedian that was popular on Channel 5 at that time. It'll come to me later. So, Ernie Kovacs. Ernie Kovacs, Howdy Doody, these were some of the early things that were a lot of fun to watch in their day. And so these pictures are being transmitted over the air, being received live, so to speak, because they had essentially no recording techniques in those days. So by cyclically scanning one line at a time, in other words, you could put up, in theory, your focal plane array, your sensitive planar structure behind the camera lens, in theory could have a zillion little bitty photo detectors, and you could have a switching network that polled each one of those photo detectors one step at a time, which represents a horizontal scan line, if you know what I mean. And depending on how much brightness each one gets, at that instant of time, you transmit that amount of voltage, which represents the brightness of that portion of the signal. And in the case of NTSC, the National Television Selection Committee, or Standard Committee of the United States, the standards by which the United States decided to transmit television, let me drop, is that there's 525 horizontal scan lines done in an interlacing manner. The 525 divided by 2 is roughly 212. So you transmit 212 of the odd lines, line number 1, 3, 5, 7, and so on, and then you scan the even lines, number 2, 4, 6, and 8. That's called the interlacing technique. By using that interlacing technique, you get less flicker of the picture, you get less artifacts of motion of the picture, and after you scan each individual horizontal line, the television set, the television transmitter, transmits an extremely strong pulse for a fraction of a microsecond, which represent the horizontal synchronizing pulse of that particular horizontal line. And after you transmitted 212 of those odd lines,